Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 809, Days of Future Past. All in the Manson Family? This is being recorded on September 7th of the year 2014. This program will be a little bit different in form than others. It is going to be one continuous, roughly 60-minute segment, and that is because that stems largely from the fact that much of this broadcast is an excerpt of Miscellaneous Archive Show M as in Mary 16, The Ultimate Evil Part 3, that was recorded on May 15th of 1988. While the nation's attention was focused on the election campaign in the fall of 2012, an interesting story about the Manson family murders and the possibility that there may have been more killings performed by that group or in the name of that group than has come to light to date. We're going to begin the program with an article that is titled, 12 Unsolved Murders Have Possible Ties to Manson Family, LAPD Says. This is by Samantha Tata, T-A-T-A, that's T as in Target, A as in Apple, T as in Target, A as in Apple, and Robert Kovicic, that's K-O-V-I-C-I-K, both are from NBC News. And this story is from October 18th of 2012. It reads in part, the LAPD on Thursday announced it has opened investigations on a dozen unsolved homicides near known Manson family hangouts around L.A. The revelation came amid a legal battle to obtain hours of audio tape recordings between former Charles Manson follower and convicted murderer Charles Tex Watson and his lawyer. Quote, we have an obligation to the families of these victims, unquote, Commander Andy Smith told NBC4, continuing, quote, our detectives need to listen to these tapes. The tapes might help with solving these murders, unquote. News of the open investigation was first reported by the Los Angeles Times Thursday and confirmed by NBC4 to LAPD officials. Smith told the Times that 12 murders they are investigating, quote, are similar to some of the Manson killings, unquote. Manson and his followers shot to infamy in 1969 after the murders of pregnant actress Sharon Tate and four others at the Benedict Canyon home in the hills above Los Angeles. The rampage was followed the next night by the murders of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca in their Los Feliz, F-E-L-I-Z, home. The unheard recordings sought by the LAPD were made more than four decades ago after Watson's arrest for his role in the Tate LaBianca slayings. LAPD's effort to obtain the tapes was not known publicly until it was reported by NBC4 News in May. And Watson has been fighting to keep those tapes under wraps. Police believe they may hold clues to, quote, additional unsolved murders committed by followers of Charles Manson, unquote. Well, we have discussed the Manson family in the past, and one of the things that we have noted is that the public handling of the Manson family case overlooks or deliberately omits a number of aspects of the investigation, including the links between various Nazi and fascist groups, including elements of the Aryan Brotherhood, very sophisticated and lethal prison gang that has grown up in the country that has a specific white supremacist outlook. We looked at them in, among other programs, For the Record 298. Also, the Manson family killings have a very interesting political dimension. We're going to go into that at greater length throughout much of the show. One of the killings I wonder about as possibly being one of the crimes that was referred to in that NBC News story that I just excerpted, and that is the murder of a woman named Marina, M-A-R-I-N-A, Elizabeth Habe, H-A-B-E. From her Wikipedia entry, we find the following. Elizabeth Habe was the daughter of Hans Habe and a student at the University of Hawaii. She was murdered while returning home from a date. She may have been slain by members of the Manson family. Her body was discovered on New Year's Day, 1969, in dense underbrush off Mulholland Drive, 100 feet west of Beaumont Drive in Los Angeles, California. She was found with contusions in the eyes, slashes in throat and heart, burns inflicted, raped, and nude except for a shoe, skipping down. A former Manson family associate said that members of the Manson family knew her. And one of the things I wonder about is whether that killing may have been in revenge for or to send a message about the writing and explicit anti-fascist activities of her father, an Austrian expatriate named Hans Habe. His Wikipedia entry reads in part as follows, speaking of Habe. In 1930, he began to work as a reporter for the Wiener Sonn- und Montagspost, the Vienna Sunday and Monday Post. In the following year, he became editor of the Österreichische Abendzeitung of the Austrian Evening News, one of the youngest newspaper editors ever at age 20, and then skipping down. The Anschluss, by the way, is Nazi Germany's annexation of Austria in 1938. After the Anschluss, Habe was expatriated and his books forbidden by the new Nazi government. He went into exile in France and joined the French Foreign Legion. In 1940, he was captured and interned in the Diuse Dulag campus, D-I-E-U-Z as in zebra, E, Dulag, capital B-U-L-A-G. From there, he managed to escape with the help of French friends to Lisbon, Portugal, and then emigrated to the United States. From there, he became a U.S. citizen in 1941, skipping down. In 1942, he was drafted into the U.S. Army and studied psychological warfare at the Military Intelligence Training Center in Camp Ritchie, Maryland. Then he joined the first mobile radio broadcasting company and in March of 1943, went to North Africa and participated in Operation Avalanche, the Allied landings in Italy. In 1944, he became an instructor of psychological warfare at Camp Sharp near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. In autumn of 1944, he selected a group of German writers and newspaper editors to prepare for the publishing of new newspapers after the war in Germany, skipping down after speaking of his marriage to Eloise Hart. In 1951, they had a daughter, Marina Elizabeth, who was murdered on December 30th, 1968, in Los Angeles. In addition to the activities mentioned there and his role as an anti-fascist and his role as a psychological warfare expert, officer, I should say, and helping to get genuinely democratic newspaper editors for post-war Germany, all of those things would have caused Hans Habe to run afoul of some very nasty interests. He also wrote a book that is not mentioned in his Wikipedia entry. Not surprisingly, it came out in 1964. It's called This Wounded Land, and he toured the U.S., and he had come to the conclusion, basically, that the U.S. was in serious danger of turning fascist. He also noted the activities in this country of various domestic fascist groups, including the John Birch Society, and was very suspicious and wrote of his suspicions that JFK's assassination was not the work of a lone nut. And that would have earned retribution for Hans Habe in a number of circles. And I wonder whether the murder of his daughter was meant to shut him up or was in retribution for his activities. I mention that because the Manson family killings have, again, they have had a political dimension that has been obscured. And we're going to go into that right now. This is an excerpt from Miscellaneous Archives Show M16, The Ultimate Evil, Part 3. This was recorded on May 15th, 1988, more than a quarter of a century ago. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose on-air responsibilities as a reader and commentator were essential for the realization of the archive programs. Here is that excerpt.
Indeed, one of the most important things about Lee Harvey Oswald to realize is just that, that, as Dave mentioned, that virtually everything that is commonly held to be true about Lee Harvey Oswald in the popular mythos is in fact not true at all. Lee Harvey Oswald, the story was a young man with leftist leanings who deserted the army, deserted the Marine Corps. Went to Russia.
Not only deserted the Marine Corps, but deserted the Marine Corps while supposedly giving top secret information on not only the U.S. Radar nets, but specifically the top secret U-2 spy plane to the Russians. So
That's
he
right.
not only was a Marine defector, he was a traitor.
A traitor, exactly, who left the Atsugi Naval Air Base, defected to the Soviet Union, taking with him, as Dave mentioned, the U-2 naval spy secrets for the top flight spy aircraft. Leading, of course, to the various explanations for how Lee Harvey Oswald's defection had led to the shooting down of Francis Gary Powers, etc. We won't go into that, but there's a whole other story about the downing of the U-2. Anyway, Lee Harvey Oswald spent a fairly longish time in the Soviet Union, apparently palled around with people who were supposed to have been high-level KGB operatives, according to the common stories.
In fact, as we saw, most of the people he contacted while in the Soviet Union were, in fact, left cover or diplomatic cover U.S. intelligence agents.
And for some reason, this young man who had defected from the military and, as Dave mentioned, made traitorous use of America's top secret technologies, handed over to our arch Cold War rivals, came back to the United States after deciding not to, being, interestingly enough, helped to come back to the United States by Governor John Connally of Texas, something that will come up later on, and came back to the United States, and absolutely nobody cared, and nobody bothered to debrief him, deprogram him, I suppose, or anything that you might want to call it, except for one man, a strange man named Spaz T. Rakin, supposedly from Traveler's Aid, I guess like the welcome wagon coming out to help the Oswalds, Lee Harvey Oswald and his new Soviet bride, Marina, back into the country. But in fact, Spaz T. Rakin was a member of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a key member of the World Anti-Communist League. This is the only person who met this arch-traitor and spy when he came back.
A key element, we should say, of what is now the World Anti-Communist League and what was coalescing into the World Anti-Communist League at this point. A couple of references. The whole U-2 tangle we went into in considerable detail in Guns of November program number one. And the situation of the World Anti-Communist League we looked at in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15. And in number 15, we examined the Kennedy assassination both as being one of the goals of the member organizations that were coalescing over a period of a little more than a decade in a series of organizational conferences. But also was one of the factors which helped to unite the various component sections of the World Anti-Communist League into that organization which formally incorporated in 1967.
And the World Anti-Communist League is indeed important because, as we're going to be seeing later on, a lot of these people who we're going to be dealing with have some kind of relations, peripheral or otherwise, with the World Anti-Communist League, Ed Butler being a classic example, and we're going to be talking about him in some depth tonight.
In fact, something we will go into when we read you the Guns of November this fall, but elements of the organizations which later were to coalesce into WACL, such as the Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, were instrumental in creating the rumor that Lee Harvey Oswald was being run by the Russians. We took a look at the assassination of Stefan Bandera by Bogdan Stashinsky, a reputed Soviet agent, this was being cited by elements connected with WACL as being part of the same, an assassination performed by the same group of assassins who had dispatched John Kennedy. Charles Kirsten, who was an affiliate of the WACL, was Mrs. Stashinsky's attorney at the, was Mrs. Bandera's attorney at the trial of Bogdan Stashinsky. We went into that in Radio Free America number 15. Of course, the Bandera people go all the way back to World War II. They're hooked up with people like Theodor Oberlander. Frank Wisner helped bring them into the country. Those same white Russian fascist connections and Galen connections were investigated by a law partner, Wesley Liebler, of Frank Wisner. But the very same painting of Oswald Red was being done by elements which in 1967 were to combine into the World Anti-Communist League.
Strangely enough, as in much the same circle of people that Dave has just talked about as being the ones that were painting Oswald as being a communist agent, again, the man comes back from the Soviet Union after having defected and sold out his country. The only person who meets him is somebody from the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. He gets to Dallas and settles down, and all of his friends are either people working in high levels in the aerospace industry, or they are white Russian, fierce anti-communists.
Or American Nazis.
Or American Nazis,
Such as George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the Führer of the American Nazi Party, whose name and address were in Oswald's address book.
He must have been one chummy commie to have been had so many friends that were so politically unlike him. So we have Oswald doing this. Oswald is also spending a lot of time in New Orleans, which is going to lead us to our first reading in just a moment. One of the main things that Oswald is supposedly doing in New Orleans is running the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter. Now, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee was, in fact, a small pro-Castro, pro-Cuba organization, not very politically powerful. The interesting thing, however, is that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only member of the so-called New Orleans chapter, and the folks at the actual Fair Play for Cuba Committee basically knew nothing about Oswald and had not had nothing to do with him whatsoever. So, interestingly enough, Oswald was running the Fair Play for Cuba Committee out of a small building that was part of the 544 Camp Street hookup. 544 Camp Street, a downtown New Orleans building that seemingly, except for Oswald, who was running a pro-Castro operation, supposedly out of it.
Of which he was the only member.
Was the only member. Strangely enough, the 544 Camp Street milieu was, other than that, was entirely full of strange organizations that seemed to be working with Bay of Pigs people, Bay of Pigs veterans, ferociously anti-communist ex-intelligence people, people like Guy Bannister, a former FBI man and private detective who was himself running an operation that he himself had been involved with getting together armaments for the Bay of Pigs, among other things, and was running an operation in which he spent a lot of time hanging out with ferocious anti-Castro Cubans who spent a great deal of time at 544 Camp Street. And strangely enough, there was Lee Harvey Oswald in the same building virtually next door. And
actually, what it was there were two entrances to the same building, 531 Lafayette Place and 544 Camp Street. Supposedly two different addresses, but if you walked up the flight of stairs, you arrived at the same place. So we're being asked to believe here that a fellow who had defected to the Soviet Union, betraying top secret intelligence information of the Russians, was able to return to the United States, was not met by the CIA or FBI, but instead begins palling around with a bunch of doctrinaire fascists, aerospace industry high rollers, and veteran U.S. intelligencers, was able to associate, although an alleged pro-Castro communist, was able to freely associate not only with the CIA, whose number 110669 he was, but also with the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro group, which just happened to be occupying the same address as Lee Harvey Oswald, the total membership of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee of New Orleans.
That's right. So bear in mind what we have here. This is in the spring and summer of 1963, shortly before the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald is splitting his time between Dallas, where Marina lives and where all of his aerospace industry and white Russian friends are, and New Orleans, where he is running around running the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, again, of which he is the sole member, and where he just happens to be hanging out in the same building with major anti-Castro operations, CIA operatives, ex-FBI men, gun runners, etc., etc. Now, again, our first segment we're going to read here is from the book Conspiracy by Anthony Summers, copyright 1980 by McGraw-Hill, and
a couple of the other denizens of 544 Camp Street, because you may hear quick references to them in this particular passage. One was a fellow named David Ferry, who was a former CIA pilot who'd worked first with Fidel Castro when Castro was receiving CIA support in his wars against Batista, then worked against Fidel Castro. He also was a chum of Carlos Marcello, capo mafioso for New Orleans. He was an investigator in Guy Bannister's detective office, about which you'll find that Guy Bannister's detective office was a lot more than just a detective office. He also was not only a long-standing associate of Lee Harvey Oswald's, going back to Oswald's days in the Civil Air Patrol. He also was cited by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as the main focus, as the place to begin an investigation, which they recommended to the Justice Department. Also, incidentally, the major focus of Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans as well.
And another person being referred to in this article will be, they'll be calling her Mrs. Roberts. This is Delphine Roberts, the lady friend of Guy Bannister herself, an extremist right-wing political figure, and somebody who, one of the people who has actually said after the fact that, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald came to Guy Bannister for a job, and the two of them had a long closed-door interview in his office, and when he came out, they appeared to have reached an understanding. Remember, again, this is Guy Bannister, who is one of the Bay of Pigs armaments people and a right-wing former FBI man, and Lee Harvey Oswald, the traitorous communist.
The CIA, who was working for the CIA, just like Guy Bannister, as we're about to see.
That's right. Again, reading from Conspiracy. Bannister's brother told the Assassinations Committee that Guy, quote, mentioned seeing Oswald hand out fair play for Cuba literature, unquote. Ivan Nitschke, a business associate of Bannister and a fellow former FBI agent, recalls that Bannister, quote, became interested in Oswald, unquote, in the summer of 1963. Adrian Alba, who ran the garage next door to Oswald's place of work, testified to the committee that he often saw Oswald in the restaurant on the ground floor of 544 Camp Street. That restaurant, excuse me, had a rear exit leading up to the office section of the building, and Bannister was a regular patron. Mrs. Roberts firmly believes that whatever the nature of Bannister's, quote, interest in Oswald, it concerned anti-Castro schemes, plans which she feels certain had the support and encouragement of government intelligence agencies. As she puts it, quote, Mr. Bannister had been a special agent for the FBI and was still working for them. There were quite a number of connections which he kept with the FBI and the CIA, too. I know he and the FBI traded information due to his former association, unquote. Bannister's former employee, Daniel Campbell, also became convinced that his boss was involved with the FBI. An FBI report of an interview with Bannister after the assassination, that's, of course, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, indicates that he was asked questions about anti-Castro exiles, but none at all about Oswald, or use of the 544 Camp Street address on Oswald's leaflets. As for Bannister and the CIA, an Assassinations Committee check revealed only that the agency, quote, considered using Guy Bannister Associates for the collection of foreign intelligence, unquote, but decided against it. That, however, was in 1960, 3 years before the episode of Oswald in New Orleans. Delphine Roberts says, quote, I think he received funds from the CIA. I know he had access to large funds at various times in 1963. She adds that known intelligence agents and law enforcement officers frequently visited Bannister's office. 16 years ago, she accepted the comings and goings as quite normal, because so far as she was concerned, the strangers were involved with her boss in, quote, doing something to try to stop what was taking place, the danger that was facing this country because of Cuba, unquote. The anti-Castro exiles involved with Bannister make an intriguing list. There was Sergio Arcacha Smith, an extreme right-winger who had served under Castro's predecessor, the dictator Batista. In 1961, he became New Orleans representative of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, CRC, and, at Bannister's instigation, set up the CRC office at 544 Camp Street.
That last sentence might be worth repeating here, because, again, this connection here is going to bear directly on Ed Butler and the Information Council of the Americas. And Ed Butler is a thread which is going to connect these seemingly distant events of 1963 with the depredations of the Manson family, not only an apparent Nazi and U.S. intelligence operation, but for the purposes of the Satanist theme of this archive series, an offshoot of the process umbrella cult, both a Nazi and a Satanist organization.
I'm going to read that again then. Sergio Arcacha Smith, who in 1961 became New Orleans representative of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, and, at Bannister's instigation, set up the CRC office at 544 Camp Street. CIA records reveal that Arcacha, quote, maintained extensive relations with the FBI. Two of his regular FBI contacts were name deleted, and Guy Bannister. Significantly, Bannister, supposedly long retired, is referred to flatly as an active FBI contact. Arcacha, who said privately he was controlled by the CIA, turned 544 Camp Street, in the words of one of his acquaintances, into a sort of, quote, Cuban Grand Central Station for the exiles. When Arcacha cast around for funds, he was offered a, quote, substantial donation by none other than Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans mafia boss. By 1963, Arcacha had moved to Texas, removed from his New Orleans CRC job after accusations of misappropriation of funds. Arcacha denies all knowledge of Oswald prior to the assassination, but one of his successors did encounter the alleged assassin. This was CRC delegate Frank Bartes, or Bartes, B-A-R-T-E-S, who turned up with Carlos Bringier for the court case following the street fracas. We're going to talk about that in a moment. On that occasion, he indulged in a noisy argument with Oswald. Okay, so one of the key people, Sergio Arcacha Smith, we mentioned, and Carlos Bringier. And Carlos Bringier, we're actually going to be hearing in just a little while.
Now, again, the relationship here with between the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, headed up by Lee Harvey Oswald, the only member at that time, and the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the unlikeliness of these two organizations sharing the same address. Among the people, by the way, who was also blowing in and out of the same place, and who worked as an investigator for Bannister, was Maurice Brooks Gatlin, who was a key planner at many of the planning conferences which were involved in setting up the World Anti-Communist League, of which we spoke earlier. Now, the interrelationship between the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and the Cuban Revolutionary Council and 544 Camp Street, recall these two highly unlikely organizations are sharing the same address, an extremely remote possibility under the circumstances, and in turn the relationship between Carlos Bringier, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the Information Council of the Americas, military intelligence, and Ed Butler, because Ed Butler is a fellow who's going to draw together a lot of themes. What we're basically looking at here is a U.S. intelligence disinformation milieu, one that will operate in the Robert Kennedy assassination, one that will operate in the John Kennedy assassination, as we're looking at, one which will figure in the disinformation storm surrounding the Manson family provocations in 1969, and one which also involves the political milieu behind Ronald Reagan as well. Now, returning once again to Anthony Summers' conspiracy, Carlos Bringier, the exile in the New Orleans clash with Oswald, certainly had direct contact with the CIA. He was New Orleans delegate of the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, the outgrowth of a militant Cuban student group. The group had naturally been deeply involved with the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion and continued to receive funds afterward. The Assassinations Committee found that Bringier had reported his contact with Oswald to his group's headquarters in Miami and that the information had in turn been relayed to the CIA. A document obtained from the agency reveals that the CIA had, quote, past contact with Carlos Bringier. Contact was limited to domestic service activities, unquote. As we noted in the case of George de Morenschild's CIA contacts, the Domestic Contacts Division is best known for its efforts to obtain information from travelers returning from communist countries. However, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title rather than Domestic Operations Division, the clandestine department which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Carlos Bringier, as New Orleans head of the DRE, also published a right-wing news sheet backed by the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. That committee was founded by the CIA. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Let me repeat that last sentence again. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Very little about that, it seems, was spontaneous. First, Carlos Bringier, by the way, B-R-I-N-G-U-I-E-R is how his last name is spelled, called William Stuckey, S-T-U-C-K-E-Y, a young reporter who had a weekly radio show on station WDSU. Stuckey went to see Oswald and found him a clean-cut, articulate figure, quite the opposite of the unkempt, wild-looking, left-wing prototype he had anticipated. After recording and broadcasting the initial interview, one which he would later recall as oddly deliberate, unquote, Stuckey then began planning a follow-up debate program. What ensued was a classic case of media manipulation for political profit. Stuckey found himself positively showered with information guaranteed to smear Oswald. First, there was a telephone conversation with either the head or the deputy head of the local FBI office, who obligingly read out large extracts from Oswald's file. Thus did Stuckey learn of Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. Soon, the industrious Bringier popped up again, eager to impress similar information on the reporter. He said he had obtained it by sending an anti-Castro colleague to see Oswald, posing as a Castro sympathizer. Finally, the same day, Stuckey received a phone call from Edward Butler, director of a right-wing propaganda organization called the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA. Butler confided that after telephone calls to Washington, he had confirmed Oswald's Soviet connections with, quote, someone at the House Un-American Activities Committee, unquote. The very title, Information Council of the Americas, unquote, speaks volumes for its origins and allegiances. At the time of the Oswald revelations, its manager was a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro government in exile created by the CIA. And I would add, but although Anthony Summers doesn't have it in this passage, he had it in the previous passage, the same organization which under Sergio Arcacha Smith and the obliging Guy Bannister had set up shopkeeping at 544 Camp Street, the other walk-up address to the entrance to 531 Lafayette Place, which was housing Lee Harvey Oswald's ostensible pro-Castro activities. Now, Ed Butler is the key name here in the intersection between the CRC, 544 Camp Street, and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is to be noted.
Now, as they mentioned, every single step of the way, people are fighting to have Lee Harvey Oswald identified as being a communist. Now, bear in mind, this is a man who apparently was of no interest to anybody when he came back from the Soviet Union, has a tiny little supposedly progressive political organization or left-wing political organization of which he is the only member, and yet people are calling up night and day, calling Washington. The FBI is reading his files out over the phone. Carlos Bringier, who himself is a top kicker in a large anti-Castro organization, is putting a lot of time into this guy who has no members and no sway and no clout whatsoever.
Well, beyond that, this is a guy who is pro-Castro, who's able to move in the same milieu with the anti-Castro Cubans, and the recent revelations under the Iran-Contra scandal focused once again the spotlight of public scrutiny on the venality and the bloody history of the anti-Castro Cubans.
Absolutely.
So we're now going to listen to a tape of the interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, Ed Butler of the Information Council of the Americas, headed up by a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which again is set up shop at 544 Camp Street, along with Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee. You could call this the Red Bucket Brigade. We're now going to listen to a tape of the second of those interviews on radio station WDSU in New Orleans.
Tonight, Bill Stuckey and I are talking with three guests, Lee Harvey Oswald, who is local secretary of a group called Fair Play for Cuba, and with Ed Butler, the executive director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee and obviously anti-Castro. Mr. Oswald, as you might imagine, is on the hot seat tonight, and I believe, Bill Stuckey, you have a question for him.
Yes, Mr. Oswald, I believe you said in reply to a question from Mr. Butler that any questions about your background were extraneous to the discussion tonight. I disagree, because of the fact that you refused to reveal any of the other members of your organization, so you are the face of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Therefore, anybody who might be interested in this organization ought to know more about you. For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long drawn out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just one second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date, and it said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16, 1959?
As I've already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left, is getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. As I have stated, it is very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the date that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy, getting this permission.
Were you ever in a building at 11 Kuznetskaya Street in Moscow?
Kuznetskaya?
Mm-hmm.
Kuznetskaya is the, that would be probably the foreign ministry, I assume. No, I was never in that place, although I know Moscow, having lived there.
Mr. Butler, let me interrupt, and I think Mr. Oswald is right to this extent. We should get around to the organization, which he is ahead of here in New Orleans, Fair Play for Cuba.
Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when in his last speech of July 26 of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, while Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugar cane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee. Thank you very much, and good evening.
Good evening indeed. Now stay tuned here. That concludes the brief interview, staged, and we use the word staged advisedly, on radio station WDSU in New Orleans in 1963, 25 years ago. Now bear in mind the connections that we talked about immediately before the interview of Lee Harvey Oswald on WDSU, the interrelationship between his Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, 544 Camp Street, the Information Council of the Americas, the CIA, Military Intelligence, and Ed Butler. Because we're going to pick up with Ed Butler now on the west coast of the United States, and we're going to examine what he was doing the night after Robert Kennedy's assassination. Here's an excerpt now from Radio Free America show number 12. This is going to take about 30 to 35 minutes for those of you who are taping. This will be self-explanatory. We're going to pick up with the career of Ed Butler and pay particularly close attention to his intersection with the milieu involved with the Robert Kennedy assassination and his involvement with putting out disinformation concerning the Manson family.
Okay. Reading from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. At 7:15 on the evening after the RFK shootings, a compact man with goggle eyeglasses marched into LAPD headquarters with four companions. He gave his name as Major Jose Antonio Duarte and said he and his men were, quote, freedom fighters against Fidel Castro. A Cuban exile, Duarte reported that on May 21st he had attended a leftist meeting because he knew that support for Castro was on the agenda. When he rose to speak out, he said, a small olive-skinned young man angrily accused him of being a CIA agent, and they got into a shoving match. The young man was Sirhan Sirhan. Duarte tried to unload his story on the news media, but it was ignored. Then on June 11th, the Anaheim Bulletin headlined, quote, pro-Castro link to RFK slaying. The article, written by Duarte's political associate John Steinbacher, recounted the Cuban's putative encounter with Sirhan. Steinbacher arranged radio appearances for Duarte, and in an instant paperback book, Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, The Man, The Mysticism, The Murder, summed up, quote, Mayor Sam Yorty of Los Angeles has already brought out the pro-communist inclinations of Sirhan, but it was left to Major Jose Duarte, the Cuban anti-communist, to link Sirhan with the riots and unrest in our nation today. In time, the LAPD discredited Duarte's identification of Sirhan by producing a look-alike Iranian student who had been at the leftist meeting and recalled being involved in the altercation. However, the entire scenario struck us, meaning the authors, as all too familiar. In August 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald was accosted by an anti-Castro exile while handing out pro-Castro literature on the streets of New Orleans. Shortly after the scuffle, Oswald was invited to participate in a radio debate on the subject. In the evening of the day John Kennedy was shot, taped excerpts were broadcast nationally, and Oswald was heard by millions proclaiming, quote, I am a Marxist. Both the debate and the assassination evening airing of the excerpts were arranged by Edward S. Butler, who headed a right-wing propaganda outfit in New Orleans called the Information Council of the Americas, INCA, which we've talked about already. By 1968, Butler had moved to Los Angeles, where he carried on with financial aid from Patrick J. Frawley, Jr., chief executive officer of the Schick Safety Razor Company. For years, Frawley generously supported hardline conservatives such as Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, and Sam Yorty. Frawley and Yorty belonged to the American Security Council, an embodiment of the military-industrial complex that lobbied for a bigger military establishment and ran a political blacklist service for its large corporation clients. Anthony Hilder also claimed to have the backing of Frawley. This is John Steinbacher's buddy. And Butler was present when Steinbacher and Hilder held their unattended press conference. Thus, a right-wing clique colored the facts and conjured up visions of a sinister occult cabal to depict Sirhan as the pawn of an international plot. As the Anaheim Bulletin rhetorically asked in an editorial, quote, "Are foreign influences at work to conquer this country? Is a hidden plot progressing to eliminate the liberal leadership of the country and throw the movement completely into control of communist agents?" Unquote.
Of course, Patrick Frawley is a member of the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine that we read, the membership list, a partial membership list we read at the beginning of the broadcast. And, of course, obviously, Patrick Frawley intimately involved with the rise of Ronald Reagan, very close to Ed Butler and a sponsor of Ed Butler's. And we're going to take a look at Ed Butler's connections to the Robert Kennedy assassination and use him to perhaps clue in yet another neo-Nazi element with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, because as we're looking at the Aryan Nations, these Nazis are cropping up in connection with a lot of very important events here. Now, recall that two of Robert Kennedy's primary assistants in his Los Angeles area campaign, at whose house he had dinner the night before he was assassinated, were the director Roman Polanski and the late actress and his wife Sharon Tate. Now, we looked at that in Radio Free America number 9. One thing we did not discuss there, and which we'll only have a time to summarize now, is the fact that Robert Kennedy, at this dinner the night before he was assassinated, made the statement that he was going to wait until after he was elected and in the White House, and then he was going to reopen his brother's killing. Well, of course, that was never to be, because on June 5th, the day Edgar Eugene Bradley was to be the hearing for his extradition was to be held, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Obviously, we've covered that before. Now, one of the interesting things is, of course, that about a year later, Sharon Tate was murdered, and a bunch of people in her house were also murdered, and eventually a bunch of people from the Manson family were convicted of this killing. Now, the Manson family has been portrayed in the popular media as, you know, a bunch of acid casualties, a bunch of screwballs acting without purpose and who were, you know, crazed on drugs and what have you and just committed these killings in a spirit of wanton butchery or whatever. But in fact, there are indications that these killings may have been political. Obviously, Sharon Tate was a key member of the Robert Kennedy campaign and had been there when Robert Kennedy made a very important statement the evening before. Roman Polanski was not at the home when the so-called Manson family showed up, but it's worth noting that the LAPD was unable to come up with the Manson family for more than a year after the killings occurred, and yet within a few months of the Tate-LaBianca killings, an interesting article appeared in a Patrick Frawley-sponsored publication called Aware. And I'm going to read you, by the way, research credit for this goes to Mae Brussel, whose broadcasts are aired on the program. And we're basically going to read you a short section here from Aware, a publication put out by Patrick Frawley, and this is from Aware's issue of October 1969. This issue is called, the article, I should say, is called Did Hate Kill Tate? And the author is Ed Butler, the same Ed Butler who we saw at the Hilder Steinbacher meeting, the same Ed Butler who arranged the Oswald press conference, the same Ed Butler who works for Patrick Frawley and is now writing for him. And he read, the interesting thing about this article is that he gives the cover story for the Tate-LaBianca killings. Recall very briefly that the official version that was given for the motivation for the Tate-LaBianca killings was that basically the Manson family wanted to start a race war. And so what they did, among other things, was they took the LaBianca's identification, a couple that they had murdered, dropped their identification off in Watts, the black section of Los Angeles, and they wrote death to the pig or kill the pig in blood, both at the Tate-Polanski residence and at the LaBianca residence, and this they hoped would lead investigators to the theory that black people, black militants such as the Black Panthers, had killed the Tates and Sharon Tate and the LaBiancas, and that this in turn would start a race war called Helter Skelter. And after that happened, then the Manson family, according to the official version, felt that they would take over. Now, the thing that's interesting about the article I'm going to read you is that Ed Butler is advancing this scenario in October of 1969. This was months before the Manson family were to be arrested, and it's interesting that the scenario he presents here is the cover story that was handed out for the motivation of their murder. Reading now from Did Hate Kill Tate. October of 69. Disturbing rumors are making the rounds in Los Angeles about the murder of Sharon Tate and friends. Drugs, sex, and racism have all been discussed publicly, but no one has mentioned the most disturbing possibility of all. We feel that the public interest will be served by bringing the darkest whispers out into the open in the hope that some reader will have information which can solve the crime. Moreover, if this chilling explanation turns out to be true, foreknowledge could help to prevent panic and thus minimize further bloodshed. The question is, was the murder of Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, and friends a part of a Mau Mau VC-type political terror campaign, American style? Is there a possibility that extremist political groups invaded the house on Cielo Drive to test the public's reaction to terror? The central clues are circumstantial, but contain enough plausibility that public discussion is warranted. Here they are. 1. The hood found draped over one of the victim's bodies. Was it a grisly turnabout on the KKK? 2. Was the rope found strung body to body an ironic reminder of lynching? 3. The word pig was scrawled in blood on the front door. Was it a challenge to the blue meanies? 4. Jay Sebring was reputed to have anti-black attitudes, according to Time magazine. Could his death have been a reprisal? Political, not racial motivation is the point. The Black Panthers have recently concluded at least a surface alliance with the American Communist Party, and yet are known for their advocacy of violence against the white power structure. Continuing. The alliance with the communists suggests that more Panther activities will be directed by white communists whose interest is disruption rather than black self-determination. Many students of revolution realize that as a crisis heats up, attacks on the establishment escalate in intensity. If the tyrannists are serious about revolution, the time is approaching when terror and assassination will be part of the modus operandi. Individual members must be trained for this work in order to be properly brutalized when the big push is necessary to seize state power. Why pick on seemingly apolitical persons like Sharon Tate and her guests? For the purpose of promoting terror and confusion in the populace at large, random murder in a plush suburban sanctuary like Bel Air might meet initial revolutionary requirements. Better than pinpointed assassination of known enemies on the street, for it would serve notice that henceforward nobody would be safe anywhere. Working up hate against the obviously privileged residents of Bel Air would be easier than provoking the same sentiments against citizens living in a lower middle class area. Any human is hesitant about murder, but if he starts with class enemies, unquote, who ostentatiously deserve it, unquote, he may be more easily persuaded to go after others in more modest circumstances at a later date. And of course, there was the possibility that both Sharon Tate's husband, Roman Polanski, and Frykowski, both expatriates from communist Poland, were not apolitical at all. A final note of interest is that shortly after the Tate murders, a suburban couple was killed in Silver Lake. Many of the same ritualistic symbols, including the lynch rope, the hood, and the word pig, were left as a spine-tingling warning. Some discount the possibility that the two murders were committed by the same gang. Others are certain that it was. But whether the two murders were done by the same terrorists, or the second was the result of contagion and imitation due to the publicity given to the Tate murder, the event illustrates the power of media publicity and propaganda in inspiring actions. And it raises the almost certain possibility that even if no extremist group was involved in the Tate murder, hate propaganda may have motivated the murderer, even if it was a lone lunatic. Why else brand the word pig on the door in a final furious frenzy? Propaganda which turns people into pigs and therefore justifies slaughtering them cannot be ignored in determining the responsibility for the violence which has ripped the nation. The Lee Harvey Oswald I knew was motivated to murder President John F. Kennedy by Castroite hate propaganda. Saran, it seems, was motivated to murder Robert F. Kennedy by the vicious anti-Semitic fulminations of Nasser. And finally, links between the accused assassin of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the vitriolic diatribes of the KKK have been alleged.
So again, noting the presence of Ed Butler and his role in the WDSU broadcast in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald and Carlos Springer, noting also Ed Butler's presence in Los Angeles the night after the Robert Kennedy assassination, and also his authorship of an article for the Aware publication that gave as the probable explanation for the Tate-LaBianca killings the cover story that it was black militants, unquote. Note the following. This is from the New York Times. We have dealt with this in For the Record Program 698, among others. From the New York Times of October 17th of 2009, CIA is still cagey about Oswald mystery by Scott Shane. It talks about the S-H-A-N as in Nancy. It talks about George Joannides, who was a CIA psychological warfare officer at the JMW station in Miami that was deeply involved with many things, including the JFK assassination. George Joannides was the case officer for the DRE, the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, of which Carlos Springer was one of the top officials. Note the following in this article. For 6 years, the agency has fought in federal court to keep hundreds of documents from 1963 when an anti-Castro Cuban group it paid clashed publicly with the soon-to-be assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, skipping down. The files in question, some released under direction of the court and hundreds more that are still secret, involve the curious career of George E. Joannides, J as in John, O A double N as in Nancy, I D E S, the case officer who oversaw the dissident Cubans in 1963. In 1978, the agency made Mr. Joannides the liaison to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, but never told the committee of his earlier role. Skipping down again. On the Kennedy assassination, the agency's deceptions, the deceptions began in 1964 with the Warren Commission. The CIA hid its schemes to kill Fidel Castro and its ties to the anti-Castro Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, or Cuban Student Directorate, which received $50,000 a month in CIA support during 1963. And again, Carlos Springer, who participated in that broadcast and attempted to get Lee Harvey Oswald to agree with Castro's statement that President Kennedy was a ruffian and a thief. Carlos Springer was an official of that group. Continuing, in August of 1963, Oswald visited a New Orleans shop owned by a directorate official, that was Springer, feigning sympathy with the group's goal of ousting Mr. Castro. A few days later, directorate members found Oswald handing out pro-Castro pamphlets and got into a brawl with him. Later that month, he debated the anti-Castro Cubans on a local radio station. Skipping down. His lawsuit, that's James Lazar, a researcher, has uncovered the central role in overseeing directorate activities of Mr. Joannides, the deputy director for psychological warfare at the CIA's Miami station, codenamed JM Wave. He worked closely with directorate leaders, documents show, corresponding with them under pseudonyms, paying their travel expenses, and achieving an important degree of control, unquote, over the group, as a July 1963 agency fitness report put it. It was in August of 63 that Oswald crossed paths with Ed Butler and Carlos Springer. And a BBC documentary, something we discussed in For the Record 582, alleges that George Joannides was also present at the Ambassador Hotel on June 5th of 1968. BBC's Newsnight of November 21st of 2006 has this article by Shane O'Sullivan, CIA role claim in Kennedy killing, unquote. New video and photographic evidence that puts three senior CIA operatives at the scene of Robert Kennedy's assassination has been brought to light. The evidence was shown in a report by Shane O'Sullivan broadcast on BBC Newsnight. It reveals that the operatives and four unidentified associates were at the Ambassador Hotel, Los Angeles, in the moments before and after the shooting on June 5th of 1968. The CIA had no domestic jurisdiction, and some of the officers were based in Southeast Asia at the time with no reason to be in L.A., skipping down. The three of these men have been positively identified as senior officers who worked together in 1963 at JM Wave, the CIA's Miami base for its secret war on Castro. David Morales was chief operations officer and once told friends, quote, "I was in Dallas when we got the son of a bitch, and I was in Los Angeles when we got the little bastard," unquote. George Joannides was chief of psychological warfare operations and was called out of retirement in 1978 to act as a CIA liaison to the congressional investigation into the JFK assassination. Now we see him at the Ambassador Hotel the night a second Kennedy is assassinated. So food for thought and grounds for further research concerning the late Mr. Joannides. This concludes For the Record program number 809, Days of Future Past, All in the Manson Family? This has been recorded on September 7th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.